Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, when one elderly spouse kills another who's become incapacitated, is that love or murder? We'll spend this hour with writer Ann Newman, whose article in the current issue of Harper's explores the surprising complexity of these cases, which often get oversimplified and romanticized in media accounts. Lots of people become helpless at the end of their lives, but as we'll hear, it's overwhelmingly male caregivers who act to end their loved ones' lives, sometimes with the intention of killing themselves at the same time. When they survive, the criminal justice system has to figure out what to do with them. Do they go to prison, or do the courts effectively allow their acts of homicide? Our conversation starts after a short break. Assisted suicide is illegal in most of the country. But sometimes spouses who believe their elderly partners are ready to die take matters into their own hands with a plan to then kill themselves immediately after. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Media accounts tend to label these mercy killings, tragic romances in which the elderly person who orchestrated the killing was motivated entirely by love. Certainly, such stories raise questions about the laws surrounding assisted suicide and about what should happen to partners who succeed in killing a dying partner but fail to end their own lives. But as Alice Newman has discovered, these cases are often more complicated than they appear in headline form. And if we're using them to frame conversations about end-of-life issues, we should understand what is really going on. Ann Newman's story in the February issue of Harper's Magazine is called Going to Extremes: Are Homicides Among the Elderly Acts of Mercy or Malice? She joins us from the studios of NPR in New York to talk about it. Ann, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. Hi.
So you anchor this story around a man named Philip Benight, who almost exactly 2 years ago comes to in a hospital bed and is at first hopeful that the bright lights above him mean that he's died. What is his story?
Finding Philip was hard. I had been looking at cases like this for a long time, but when I finally did find him, he laid out this tale that was pretty extraordinary. He and his wife had been married for many years and were happy until and we're happy through a number of illnesses that she experienced over the course of about 14 or 15 years. First were cancer and then strokes. And so this ongoing long decline of her health throughout the end years, she was very clear that she did not want to be alive anymore. She did not want to go through that suffering, and she kind of knew what was coming. And Philip had tried to talk her out of it because he loved her and wanted to spend time with her, but he also didn't want to see her suffer. And finally, they had a hard time keeping Becky at home. She had an experience that was termed unsuitable for someone who wanted to stay at home. The health insurance company thought that she needed two caretakers while Philip was at work, and it turned out that they were unable to get permission for Becky to stay in her own home, and the Office of Aging ultimately came and got her and took her away. And she was very unhappy at the nursing home that they were keeping her in. It was a sterile environment, and as we know, elders very often react poorly to change of environment, and she was very unhappy there. And ultimately, Philip said, okay, this is what you've wanted, I'm ready. And they did what they did any night. Philip picked Becky up at the nursing home after his work, and he was a bus driver. He picked her up after work and drove her to Darren Camp's grocery store for a sandwich, and then drove her to the Burger King drive-thrus for some ice cream. And then they drove home to their driveway. And because Becky could no longer get out of the car to make it into the house, she stayed in the car while Philip went in into the kitchen and kind of dumped every pill that he could find, every prescription pill, out onto the counter and kind of split them in half with the edge of his hands. And he ground Becky's into a mortar and pestle and then mixed it into a single serving of Kraft vanilla pudding and went out back out to the car And of course, it was January. It was cold. But he opened her car door and helped her eat it. He held the spoon. She guided his hand. And when she was finished, he got into the driver's side and swallowed his own pills. And the last thing that Becky said was a response to Philip's question. He said, "How did that taste?" He was worried about the bitterness. Mm. And Becky said, "It tastes like freedom."
Hmm. But it wasn't freedom.
Did not, not for Philip. When they didn't return to the nursing home, the staff there asked the police for a wellness check. And the police found the two in their vehicle in the driveway, unconscious, and pulled them out and cut their clothes and injected them with Narcan and rushed them to the hospital. And both were in a coma, Philip for 3 days when he awoke and when this story picks up in the Harper's article. And Becky died on the 30th of January. Yesterday was the second anniversary of her death.
So we should be clear, assisted suicide is illegal in Pennsylvania where they were living and in 42 other states. So on top of his grief, Philip was forced to clean out his savings to deal with felony charges.
Yeah, and I want to be really careful with the terms here because it's a highly politicized issue. We all know suicide and its implications. We should prevent suicide at any cost. And if one is suicidal, they should find help. And we should keep an eye out for those who are suffering in that way. However, there's a difference between assisted suicide, which are the names of statutes that exist in about 34 states. They say it is illegal to help someone end their life. A fantastic case in Pennsylvania was that of Barbara Mancini a number of years ago, a nurse whose father was dying, and she handed him a full bottle of morphine when he demanded it, and then she was arrested for assisting his suicide. He was already dying. The Aid in Dying movement, which we can get into if you want, but the Aid in Dying movement, which has seen an increasing approval rate across the country over the past several decades, is now legal in 7 states and the District of Columbia. And aid in dying is the preferred term there. You'll also hear kind of the police term that was applied to Philip's case, which is spousal homicide suicide. And another term, the term that I picked up and that I use for this case because it's basically how I found that these cases were taking place in a marked way across the country, was mercy killing. I think it's very important that we distinguish between these terms because they do have political issues.
So the way we learn his story here, it feels like it's really hard not to empathize with what Philip believed he needed to do for his wife. And you found in your research that, in fact, media portrayals of these stories often use that term that you just used, mercy killings. First of all, what is the appeal, if that's the right word, of stories that portray this kind of killing as an extreme sort of devotion?
Well, I started following Google alerts. I was working on a book about end-of-life care, elder care, called The Good Death, and that was in about 2014. And I put together these Google alerts that would tell me anytime these key terms were used. And I noticed that mercy killing was coming up again and again in local papers, and it was being applied to what became evident, a pattern of white men, wives with dementia or another long-term illness. And those 4 years ago, in 2014, I started calling any scholar I could get my hands on, and because this was really alarming to me. I was concerned with the issues of domestic violence, kind of the older generation of man, of husband who was already speaking for his wife. And so her consent was usurped in a lot of these cases, was my concern. And the scholars were telling me the same thing. Yes, we should be concerned. These cases are often violent. While Philip and Becky used pills, most often used are guns. And so you know, I cover other cases in the piece where a husband takes a gun into a facility, a healthcare facility, like a nursing home or a hospital, and we don't want that. And so when I was handed my local newspaper by my sister 4 years after starting to follow this, I had been unable until that point in time to get someone to talk to me on the record. My sister handed me the cover of my local newspaper, and there was Philip's face. And so we tried to find him in a number of different ways, and ultimately I ended up just cold knocking on his door. And I didn't know what I was going to find. You know, these tales of husbands shooting their wives in the head or the chest in hospitals, it's pretty alarming. And the first thing I said to Philip was, "I'm so sorry for your loss." And I handed him this little flower that I, too, had purchased at Darren Camp's grocery store, not knowing that's where they had their last meal together. And, again, this is in my hometown, so, you know, I know exactly where I am, and we know many of the same people. So I hand him this flower. I say, "I'm so sorry for your loss." And he wept. And slumped in his chair. He was on this walker chair. And I put my arm around him. And the state that he was in, at that point, he was 3 months into his house arrest. And the hours and hours of conversation that we have had since, I realized that what was taking place was not a fault of personal responsibility. In some of these cases, these are not bad men who are doing this. There's a systemic problem that is pressuring elder couples that is not being addressed, we have a responsibility to pay attention to. Philip and Becky happened to be caught in an intersection of various different issues that that put them in this desperation. And Philip, still today, believes that he did what believes in his heart that he did what his wife wanted. In court, her family testified on his behalf, and after hours and hours, I believe that too. I believe Becky wanted to end her life, or to be honest, end her suffering. And so this case kind of puts us in the middle of, say, our desire as a society to end suicide at all, at any chance we can. And this other side of things that is kind of an examination of the past 50 years of the healthcare industry, telling us cure, 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 and giving us one treatment after another. And Philip's case kind of blows that open. And so, yes, I have more than sympathy. I have a great affection for this man who, despite the laws and everything else, followed his own commitment to his wife to do what she wanted.
But as you say, it's complicated, right? Not every couple is Philip and Becky Benight. One of the things that really I hadn't given any thought to before is that when a deeply incapacitated partner is transferred to some kind of care facility, a nursing home, it can be traumatic for that person, but it's often also traumatic for the caregiver. And I haven't heard that discussed much publicly before.
No, and sadly, it's because we don't talk about caregiving very much. Quite traditionally, this was women's work, and so we seldom value women's work. And when men are left to be the sole caretakers, they can be much more brittle. They don't have perhaps the same resources. And as our elders are now living longer, they're also dying longer. And we can talk about how the medical industry has conspired to give us this longer death period. But that's the period of time that we're not addressing. We don't provide adequate healthcare coverage for so many people. If you are terminally ill, you can get healthcare, hospice coverage, but that only covers 4 hours a day.
My guest is writer Anne Newman. Her story in the February issue of Harper's is called "Going to Extremes: Are Homicides Among the Elderly Acts of Mercy or Malice?" You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking with writer Anne Newman about her story in the February Harper's Magazine, "Going to Extremes: Are Homicides Among the Elderly Acts of Mercy or Malice?" And why would these cases more often be men than women assisting with ending someone else's life and then trying to end their own, when we know that statistically women are vastly more likely to be caregivers to a critically ill partner?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. It's important to note that these cases have a whole range of causes. It could be like Philip's case, where a husband is helping his wife out of a desperate situation that they both consider worse than death. Or it could be, you know, something perhaps in the middle, where we're looking at a husband and wife where the husband has basically usurped his wife's consent or assumed his wife's consent and is you know, responding to a host of factors, one of which is he assumes that her situation is no longer tenable. To, of course, the ultimate act of domestic violence, which is husbands ending their wives' lives. And so we see this whole range, and again, very complex factors that feed into each. What I've homed in on tends to be white men. So we could also ask the question of why is it white men? Who are ending their wives' lives. And, you know, for the purpose of Philip's case, it could be just that he falls into that pattern. But also it could be the way that these are reported. Again, I was getting, you know, Google alerts from local newspapers across the country. And that's a really inexact way to study the data. So we don't really know what's taking place across the country. There is no one way of tracking these deaths. In some counties, coroner numbers are used. In others, it's the police reports. So what we're looking at are local reporters who deem a death to be a quote-unquote mercy killing and write it up as such. You had asked earlier about the romance of that term, like why is that term being used? And I think in part race would answer that question. Hmm. I had a scholar, Jacob Apple, tell me that he couldn't think of one black couple who have been identified as ending their lives in this manner. And let me just say that we're referring to people over the age of 65, roughly. So, you know, local journalists could be responding to, say, you know, white homicide suicides in one way and in other places, black homicides and suicides in another. The other thing is that for family members who are most often gone to or addressed by journalists, family members very often tend to say, you know, my parents loved each other. You know, I spoke to a woman named Kelly Dresser LeCount, and her father, when her mother was in the hospital, went into the facility and shot her mother in the chest and was released because he was very elderly. But he wanted to be with his wife, and Kelly believes and needs to believe and wants to believe, and I think she could be right. Her parents did not want to be separated. And so family members tend to overlay the story of love between this couple. I think that's the case with Will, Philip and Becky. They loved each other very much. And they had this conspiratory, wonderful sense of humor. But I think she wanted out and he helped her.
You know, when you talk about a couple like the Dressers, where he went to her hospital and shot her and tried to shoot himself, it strikes me, it makes sense that families want to sort of add this meaning to this inexplicable thing. It also gets us off the hook as a society, doesn't it? We don't have to ask ourselves how someone got into such a position where they feel so desperate that they could consider an act like this if we tell ourselves that, as sad as it was kind of noble and beautiful at the same time.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Chris, and I'm glad you said it so succinctly. This conversation about homicide suicides, calling them mercy killings, really masks so many other issues that are with our healthcare system, with, say, ageism in our country, where we, you know, we don't check in on our neighbors. We're not good at doing that and staying in touch. Police who are called out on wellness checks aren't, you know, identifying these patterns, like this couple does not look, you know, well dressed or clean, mm-hmm. or you know, their hair is unkept, or they look like they've lost weight. So a host of health and social systems are failing these couples in a way, and I kind of think of that this pattern or these mercy killings as kind of the canaries who are telling us we've got serious problems in the coal mine, and we all know this to some extent, right? I looked it up this morning. How many uninsured people in Dallas-Fort Worth area? Texas has the highest percent and number of uninsured people everywhere. So everywhere in the country. So we know that these underlying issues exist. These couples shine a light on the fact that we're calling them mercy killings, but that allows us to avoid the larger questions, and they're very complicated, nuanced questions that undergird these deaths. But also, we're not then working on prevention. We're not identifying ways in which we could help them. I come back again and again to this. Imagine being so desperate as a husband that you are helping, that you help your wife to die. And that's a horrifying situation that these elders are put into.
How much difference does it make to courts and to prosecutors whether those who kill their dying partners or help them kill themselves mean well? Does the law make any distinction whatsoever, or are we operating in a gray area when prosecutors are sort of making choices about when to push these cases and when to let them go?
I spoke to this fabulous expert, a fabulous scholar in Florida named Donna Cohen, who's actually been testifying on behalf of some of the gentlemen who survived these episodes. And what she's found is that judges have no way to quantify what these men have done. Either they're bad men or they're not. From everything I've seen, there are a range of sentences from 25 years to one man named Dennis Kopp in Utah to, you know, Philip was given 6 months or less, or 6 months house arrest. I also just mentioned the Dresser family, and Mr. Dresser was left to go home because the DA said that he would be too expensive to take care of. He was so ill. So there's a huge range. Judges don't really know what to consider. And Cohen said, we should really think of compassion as a mitigating circumstance, just like we consider in murder cases aggravated assault or anger. And so talking about these, making these cases much more prevalent in our understanding, I hope will help courts and judges to think about the broader implications that they're pointing us to.
Were you able to draw any conclusions as to why these cases are happening more frequently in the past few years?
Yeah, I mean, there's the long story and the short story, right? We're at a period of time where the dying process is taking a really long time. And mm-hmm. part of that is testament to the fact that we just have a fantastic medical system if you have health coverage. So we've extended the human lifespan so much in the past century. In the past 50 years, we've matched that with all of these medical advancements. And in the United States, kind of two movements have been running parallel to address people's fears of what healthcare can do. Cases like Karen Ann Quinlan, who in 1975 was in an accident, and her she was diagnosed in a PVS state, and there was a huge nationally publicized court case to have her feeding tube removed. The second case was in 1983 of Nancy Cruzan in Missouri. And of course, the one that we're all familiar with is Terry Schiavo, who died in 2005 but had experienced her accident or collapse in her kitchen in 1990. And those many of those years, 1990 to 2005, her family members were engaged in a court battle to remove her feeding tube. So the public, we're watching all of this. We know that respirators and defibrillators, quote-unquote life support or physiological support, can keep the body alive for a long time. And what we're left with is the brain. And we don't really know, you know, how much of the brain makes you alive or dead. And so the hospice movement has come out of that or run alongside the advancement of legal efforts, whether it's the legalization of aid in dying, but also kind of a plethora of state specialized advance directives or legal documents that will allow us to say what we do and don't want when we're dying. And so these cases are showing us this kind of 50-year history. They're also showing us kind of the financial impossibilities of affording health care that meets our needs. Right before we went to break, I was trying to express that we don't have any coverage for care in the home. If you do pay someone under the table, in New York City it's $13. I think in Dallas-Fort Worth I saw estimates between $13 and $17. But there's no – few families can afford that kind of full-time care. So let's say your beloved mother is incontinent. She's not yet diagnosed as terminal, but she's 85, and she just needs someone to help her get to the bathroom and do her daily living activities, you know, like getting dressed and showered. Families now are trying to do that themselves while they're working two or three jobs, and health insurance just does not help. It doesn't cover it. So the first factor is we're in this moment in history where our medical systems kind of are keeping our bodies, you know, alive much longer than ever before, and we're not quite sure how to deal with that. And the second is that we don't have health coverage that will facilitate families that are trying to keep up with this caretaking and just can't.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. This causes me to wonder if the fact that by and large, this care is provided more often by women than by men, more often by wives than by husbands, more often by daughters than by sons. And I want to take nothing away from the very good men who are taking on this work. But I wonder if health insurance doesn't cover it because it's seen, as you said, to be women's work and because women will get it done even if nobody helps.
We all know women's strengths. Women are accustomed to doing this kind of caretaking. Historically, women are the ones who have done this work. So, I think the lack of attention to caregiving in the home, and this is the whole spectrum, right? It's caring, raising children. It's, you know, keeping the refrigerator full, these sorts of things. And while some of that is changing now, these are historically women's roles, and so they don't have the same value to us as men's tasks. So that's part of it. But I also think that men maybe don't have, you know, the social networks or the ability to manage all of these things. But that's some and not all. And mm-hmm. again, what Phillips' case does is allow us to say, what do we do for these families? What do we do for these elder couples who want out, who just want out? But also, how do we address the spectrum of problems that each of these cases presents to us? So it could be Philip, or it could be a domestic violence case where the cops have showed up at the door for three times and nothing is done, and then we know that a dementia patient has been killed by her husband. So there's a full range, and I think we should refrain from generalizing. Mm-hmm. And each type of example gives us a lesson, provides us with a lesson.
All right, let's go to the phones. We have Jeffrey on the line in Dallas. Hi, Jeffrey.
Hey, Chris, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
Good. I am wondering why we as a nation, especially with healthcare costs rising, are not looking at humane end-of-life care as a real option, because so many people with terminal illnesses are treated for a very long time to no effect. And the healthcare costs just keep piling up. In many cases, as you mentioned, people are bankrupt or forced to drain their life savings. And so I'm just curious as to why we are not looking at this as an option.
What do you think, Anne?
Yeah. Thanks for calling, Jeffrey. I mean, you just kind of hit the big nail on the head, right? We're not providing enough coverage for these elders who are dying. We don't have quality end-of-life care, and we don't really know why. I mean, we're not providing health care, you know, point blank. There are people in the country who don't think that that is anything other than personal responsibility. And that position wholeheartedly denies all the value to just a general healthy society. So there are huge problems in how we understand the plight of people as they age, and their families who are taking care of them as they age. I mean, why there's nothing between, I don't know, general medical practice and a hospice caretaker, I have no idea. But that's where many families will find themselves. And if you put the money together of the cost of a 24-hour home health aide right now, again, it's got to be out of pocket unless you've got long-term insurance. And raise your hand if you do. You can pay more a year than you earn just to have a proper home health aide for your loved one.
In places in the United States where it is possible to receive medical assistance in ending one's life, we should note that many doctors refuse to be a part of it. In just a minute, we'll talk about that with my guest, writer Anne Newman. Her story in the February issue of Harper's is called Going to Extremes: Are Homicides Among the Elderly Acts of Mercy or Malice? This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking with writer Anne Newman about her Harper's Magazine story this month, Going to Extremes: Are Homicides Among the Elderly Acts of Mercy or Malice? You can join our conversation by calling 800-933-5372. So, Anne, you explained that in states where it is legal for a doctor to provide a patient help with ending his or her own life, lots of doctors refuse to be part of that. Of course, that's their choice to offer the procedure or help with it or not. But you write that what it means is that the people who actually can get this professional help tend to be people with lots of financial resources and lots of education.
Yeah, and I'm still not convinced that were aid in dying legal in Pennsylvania, it would have helped Philip and Becky. Mm-hmm. And certainly in a lot of the cases that kind of skew into the, I don't know, the questionable area of was the husband acting in his wife's consent or on her behalf, I think there are instances where the trigger was in fact that a trigger, and it was a sudden decision or a desperation that the requirements and regulations surrounding legal aid in dying simply would not have addressed. So that's a byproduct of how aid in dying movement has evolved in our country. The first bill was passed in Oregon in 1994, way back, and it was a ballot initiative. So everyone got together and drew up these guidelines, and then voters were asked to yay or nay. After 94, there were a huge number of national efforts by the administration, presidential administration, to try and strike that law down. And it took until 2009 for Washington, the second state, to pass aid in dying. The requirement, and I could go on, that there are seven states and the District of Columbia where it's legal now, including California. On the fifth attempt, there are multiple efforts at any given time across the country. I think there are like a dozen right now. But the requirements are, with the exception of Montana, pretty uniform. A patient has to have 6 months or less to live. They have to request aid in dying with writing or verbally. Sometimes there's a waiting period. They can then get the prescription from the doctor if they can find a doctor. And then they have to self-administer that lethal drug, meaning they've got to put it in their own mouth. And so those who tend to use this are those who are self-informed. They say, oh, wait a minute, this is my my cancer's back. This is the second round, so I know what's ahead of me. And I don't want that. I don't want to go through the suffering and the indignity of dying of this metastasized cancer. And so I want a lethal prescription. And some states it's harder than others. And I mean, you and I can discuss the reasons why. I think there's a lot of pressure on doctors. It's really easy to say, you know, quote unquote, I don't want a doctor who kills people. And that's a really difficult thing to argue against. This is complex stuff. And I would prefer that we're, you know, much more private for patients to make that decision. But doctors still feel that pressure. I think the way that these regulations have evolved have made it difficult to use aid in dying. I think it's primarily used by white, wealthy patients, you know, with some education, and because they're the ones that are more informed. Among those who are advocating for better death and dying process in this country, I think the emphasis on the conversation is a real problem, because the conversation is self-help in the definition of the word, not the popular books, as opposed to an understanding that so many of these problems are systemic, and we have to change the system, or we're really only going to get the people that get that message, which tends to be white people with, you know, some money and education.
Understandably, many, many people worry about any kind of system in which someone else gets to decide that the life of a person no longer has value and sort of, you know, make a move to end that person's life. I wonder, though, if there is even anecdotal evidence and that this is happening quietly, off the record, in a lot of situations. You know, a dose of morphine that someone understands will probably hasten the end of a person's life.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And it's, you know, it's again, terms and medical ethics and how they've discerned particular behavior. Terminal sedation is giving someone enough morphine that they are not panicked or having trouble breathing, but it can also kill them. It's called the double effect. And this is why, at least legally, aid in dying is permitted in Montana. On New Year's Eve of 2009, the Supreme Court there said, yeah, there's no difference between what doctors call the double effect. I'm giving you enough morphine, patient, so that you're not in pain, but it might also end your life. And aid in dying, which is a patient saying, give me enough drugs to end this because I'm in pain. A lot of this comes down to terms, which I was so adamant at the beginning, like, let's get the terms straight. Because you'll find there's a huge polarization politically on, you know, the Catholic Church, for instance, is very particular about calling legal aid in dying assisted suicide. And they want that suicide word to be in there to make us uncomfortable because, of course, the Catholic Church operates, 620 of our hospitals in this country, a lot of them in Texas.
All right, let's go back to the phones. We have Nick calling from Fort Worth. Hi, Nick.
Hey. I just had a question for Anne. If there'd been any cost-benefit analysis done on providing home aids from Medicare versus these sorts of consequences of not.
Thanks for calling.
That's a great question, Nick. I don't know any studies, but I'm hoping that there are some. But I see what you're saying. Like, would it be beneficial to cover home health aides under Medicare instead of out of pocket, as it typically is now? I think the problem is that we don't know what we're weighing it against, right? We're estimating, and again, we know that this is a rough estimate, but we're estimating there are like 108 successful or attempted mercy killings that have taken place in the country in the past year, right? Or how do we measure that if we say this couple loved each other and there are no consequences, or if we actually don't track it accurately? We're not calculating those costs, and that's the problem. And so we don't know what to measure it against. Also, I think it's a real problem if we only look at this as, and you know this, it probably wasn't the basis of your question, but if we're monetizing bodies, somebody's making the money, right? Somebody's always going to be making the money. And there is a problem with not thinking of human cost. We do that too much. And when it comes to healthcare, we're a country that has plenty of money. We just use it in other ways. I wouldn't mind spending more money on healthcare if we were actually doing a good job of taking care of our people. And right now, we really aren't.
If you are over the age of 65 and on Medicare and sick enough, you qualify for lots of different kinds of services, in many cases not home health aides. But I wonder if Medicare provides for or requires any kind of evaluation for the family caregivers who are providing this care to people who are very sick and at the end of their lives. Is anybody checking to see whether someone's primary caregiver is very seriously depressed?
I think probably my first answer would be they need more resources. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've starved Medicare, Medicaid, and even the Obamacare to the point where these are sub-functioning systems that are in place, like so many others, and so we haven't valued that. But to do these kinds of studies, to actually put new systems or stopgap measures in place where we're doing a better job of checking on elders in a systemic way. Again, you and I need to knock on our neighbor's door because we know that they're old and, she broke her hip last week. See if they need something from the grocery store. That's our social responsibility, and that is something that communities need to pick up. But as far as building safeguards into our healthcare coverage, we just haven't done anything about that. And part of it is because capitalism is what governs that decision-making effort. I do want to point out one other thing. We haven't talked about guns, and the majority of these mercy killings take place with the use of guns, probably because they're at hand and they're the easiest to use. But I think we need to pay attention to that kind of violence. It's incredibly traumatic for families.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. So Philip Benight pleaded guilty, and you mentioned that he's on house arrest or had been. What has his life been like these past couple of years?
Well, like I said yesterday, it was 2 years since Becky died. When I met Philip, he was 3 months into a 6 month house arrest. And I think he wouldn't take this badly. He was a mess. Mm-hmm. He was deeply grieving. And I'll tell you, he wasn't grieving that that they had done what they did. He was grieving that he had not given Becky the death she wanted, the hospital and all of the things that came after the police found them in their car. He was also very isolated. He didn't expect to be alive. And so this was, a whole new world for him, trying to reimagine himself now without his wife. When he hadn't had a future just 3 days before. And I think over the remaining 3 months of his house arrest, we got to be close. We talked a lot. And more than anything, he just talked this all out. He's in therapy. And I see now that he's really on fire to try and make people aware of the plight that he and his wife found themselves in. And he, of all people, is really good at identifying the reasons why they were there. And he wants to prevent others from going through this.
He was ready to die with her. It sounds like he doesn't want to die now.
No. And I just had a chance to listen to some of our recorded interview. And I asked him multiple times over the course of, a year that I've been talking to him. I ask him, are you suicidal? And he's not. And, that's the same thing that patients who use aid in dying will tell you. Patients who use legal aid in dying, they're not suicidal. They know they're dying. They simply do not want to be in pain. They do not want to suffer, and that suffering is physical as well as existential. And they're not people that are, you know, I want to take myself out. They're people that simply know what's coming and don't want to go through the pain.
You've spent a lot of your career reporting on these issues. I wonder if you've learned what makes it easier for people to talk about the fact that we are, in fact, all going to die.
Yeah, I don't know. I think we're getting closer in the past several years. Right before my book came out, Alto Gawande's Being Mortal book came out. There's what's called a death positivity movement and death cafes. And the way I look at it is, Katie Butler has a new book out that's The Art of Dying Well. It's beautiful. She's a beautiful writer. But I think there are ways in which we're using these conversations to mask or skirt the real problems. So either we're talking about dead bodies, right? The mortician and the death cafe, we're imagining what our death will be like. And I think dying bodies are much more complicated, right? It's that pain and suffering that we should be compelled to imagine and put ourselves in that place and address. And the other thing is that most of the solutions that we've got coming at us, even Katie's beautiful book, is about having the conversation or preparing oneself for dying. And the real problem is that this is a social problem that is governed by systems, and we need to change the systems.
Anne Newman's story in the February issue of Harper's Magazine is called Going to Extremes: Are Homicides Among the Elderly Acts of Mercy or Malice? And it's been a really interesting conversation. Thanks very much for making time for us.
Thank you, Chris. It's my pleasure.